This is Radio Times. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. You know that feeling when you're having a fight with someone and you're so angry you can't think straight? You're overwhelmed with your emotions and all you want to do is win and show the other person just how wrong and stupid they are. Our guest Dan Shapiro calls that vertigo, like the Hitchcock movie, an almost trance-like state that is so overwhelming you can't think straight. He's the founder and director of the Harvard International Negotiation Program, and he's been involved in many tense and intense conflicts around the world. He's learned a thing or two about the causes of conflicts from the personal to the international and what can be done to diffuse them, even resolve them. He's got a new book. It's called Negotiating the Non-Negotiable, How to Resolve Your Most Emotionally Charged Conflicts. And Dan Shapiro, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
It's wonderful to be here with you.
You're very welcome. Nice to have you here. I was trying to figure out, so where do we begin this book? Because it's chock full of so much information. But I was thinking about the times that we live in, which does feel like highly charged, conflict-ridden. Everyone feels angry about something. And I sometimes wonder, is it just that we are surrounded by media and all this information, or do we live in a much more conflict-driven world?
Great question. I think that our world has always had conflict. It's always been a part of it's part of human nature to have difference and to try and figure out how are we going to deal with those differences. I do think that the media has been one major component in raising the profile of the polarization.
Media loves conflict.
Media loves conflict. And in fact, just last week, I was just talking about this with somebody else. I was invited onto one of the major talk shows, news shows. They asked one question before I came on board. They said, "What's your political leaning?" And I said, "I'm not going to come on your show." What they wanted was a boxing match. My interest is how do we help people deal with their differences more effectively?
Your book is about the fact that at the root of conflict are things like identity, who we are, and emotions, how we feel. And I think for a lot of people, no, it's about winning the argument. It's about having the facts at hand. You're saying no. If you boil it down, that's really what's at stake.
People often assume conflict is a rational process, that negotiation is all about rationality. Let's just problem solve our differences and then we can move on with our lives. The reality is, even in the most trivial of conflicts, emotions are always there, identity is always there. And when our identity starts to feel threatened on some level, that's the tripwire for a lot of forces. All of a sudden, it becomes us versus them, me versus you. Even if it's in a family context with loved ones, the moment the identity feels threatened, the wall, you know, the waters part, sort of like Moses in the sea.
But let's take a very concrete example, and psychologists tell us that one of the things that couples argue about is money. I mean, that's one of the number one arguments. Mm-hmm. Are you saying when couples are arguing about money, they're not arguing about money?
Absolutely. Well, they are arguing about money. So at the same time, there are these deeper questions at play. Who makes the choice in the family about how the money is distributed, how things get budgeted? Wait a minute. You're telling me that this is what I must do? You're telling me I can't go on the, you know, use that extra internet time and it costs more and I feel like you're controlling me now. Yeah, it's about money, but it's really about the relationship. How much autonomy does each of us have within the relationship to do what we want, to be who we want, to feel what we want? So we all want this freedom in relations. The moment our autonomy starts to feel threatened, boom, emotions are there.
Do you think, and there are many political things I want to talk about, but thinking about couples, do you think in a sense they, no matter what they're arguing about, they're really arguing about the same thing, whether it is this issue of autonomy or respect or whatever, it might show up in who's spending more money, it might show up in who's disciplining the children, but essentially there's one argument sort of at the base that, that couples argue about?
We found there are a few basic elements that are at the essence of almost any conflict. One, appreciation. Do I feel like you are appreciating me in this, you know, in a couple's relationship, or do I feel like you're in this for yourself? Two, autonomy, like we talked about. Do I feel like you're controlling me? Three, affiliation. Does it feel like it's the two of us working together, or do I feel alienated from you? Empty emotionally. I don't feel like we are there for each other. I feel excluded from this relationship that I'm a part of. Status. This is another huge dynamic in the couple's conflict.
Who has more, I guess, or who has less?
Who has more, who has less, and it's often very subtle. I can talk with you, Marty. I can talk with you very respectfully with my words, but you can suddenly hear that I'm demeaning you.
You right? absolutely are. And now I'm really mad at
you.
No, you
can feel it. Like, even it's kidding. It's like it's scary stuff. And status becomes this huge issue, whether it's in the relationship, the personal relationship, or the international. Do I feel up? Do I feel down? And then the fifth of these human motivations that we feel, that we found tends to drive a lot of conflict, is role. What's the nature of my role in relation to yours? Do I feel like I'm constantly the victim in this relationship? You're always the aggressor. And you might feel just the same thing in the opposite direction.
That's my narrative.
Exactly. Right? So these five things tend to drive a lot of the emotions that come up in a conflict situation, and they often touch upon our identity.
I remember interviewing or hearing about a couple that does a lot of work with relationships and conflict. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that they found was that they knew a couple was in trouble when there was contempt.
Yes.
I mean, people argue, they disagree. Sometimes they say things they wish they hadn't, and hopefully they take it back. Mm-hmm. But when you get to contempt, then you got problems.
You are an object, you are less than human, and you disgust me. You know, I mean, this is precisely the opposite of what I think is the essence of the good relationship, which is appreciation. I understand where you're coming from. I see the value in your perspective, and I'm letting you know. And that's extremely hard to do when suddenly your spouse becomes an obstacle to, you know, you're living the kind of life you want to live.
And they're saying no.
And
or you're
saying
wrong,
no.
Or that hurts me, or some version of that.
You're wrong, you're crazy, I'm right, why did I marry you in the first place? You know.
Well, is it in those moments of calm important then for people to say to themselves, especially if we're talking about couples here, that if this person who I love or like is telling me something, then perhaps there's some goodwill attached to it, even if it hurts me and makes me feel bad about myself?
I think to look for that goodwill is extremely useful.
To find the
value in what the other person's saying is extremely difficult. I think the essential stalemate, emotional stalemate, in most couples' conflicts is around appreciation, where each of us desperately wants to feel heard and understood and supported by that other person. But boy, we're not going to give it unless they give it first.
Yeah.
You know?
A stalemate then.
It's an emotional stalemate. And you get stuck in it. And that's the problem, but that's also the answer. Because what that means is it only takes one to change that dynamic. If I can step outside my ego a little bit and start to appreciate my wife a little bit more in the next conflict situation, she feels heard. And she's more likely then to also listen to me.
Is that when the word apology comes into play? And that's, again, not easy to do.
Yeah.
But sometimes, especially if there's something to apologize for, it actually feels good.
It can feel marvelous. You take the onus, the emotional onus of the conflict, and it sort of evaporates a bit. I think people often fall into the trap of apologizing too speedily. To get it over with. I mean, I see that with my kids. You know, they get into an argument. I'm sorry, Noah. I'm sorry, Zachary. Okay, we're done. And then 2 seconds later, they're fighting over the football now. I think apology is something that takes time. There's a lot of emotional work that goes into having a sincere, authentic apology when dealing with an emotionally charged conflict.
Yeah.
I think a premature apology can feel insincere, and it might be.
You say there's a lot we can learn from hostage negotiators in terms of negotiation and how to deal with intense, high-conflict situations.
I've worked with the New York Police Department's hostage negotiation team, Jack Cambria, some of the others. These are some of the best listeners I have ever seen in my life. Watching them in a training context negotiate with the ostensibly crazy person on the other side of that door, they will listen with such intensity, it's remarkable. Their ability to build a human connection with the other side, who might be spouting off incredibly offensive words and threats, they're there. They're listening, emotionally attuned. It's powerful. Wow. But I also think it takes work. One of the best listeners I ever met, her name was Lydia Martinez, from the New York Police Department hostage negotiation team. And I actually invited her up to Harvard at one point to show my students, how do you listen? Just the most amazing, like, sort of like you're doing now, I think, you know? I got a call one day from Jack Cambria, who was then the head of the New York Police Department hostage negotiation team. He said, I want to inform you before it breaks in the news. She took her life.
She took her life?
At the age of 48. And I don't know the backstory. My sense, she was so good at empathizing with some of the most challenging emotional people.
She took it inside, though.
It takes it inside, you know.
Well, how do we listen without feeling that we have taken on the burdens of being a good listener?
Well, I mean, it's almost inescapable that if you are truly empathizing with the other side, you will feel some of that heaviness. The challenge is, how do you deal with it?
Yeah.
You know, and she did. I mean, her colleagues loved her to death and supported her. I think she was one who internalized more than most anybody could.
But what I hear you saying is that, if we want to learn to negotiate, then we have to figure out how to listen. I mean, listen what? Without judgment? It's really hard to listen.
It sounds like, on the other hand, I think people often think, this sounds like the stupidest, the easiest thing in the world. Of course I'm listening. People don't listen. Just sitting in on now hundreds of conflicts, watching them unfold in different contexts with executives, with heads of state and others, you see the amount of information that each side conveys to the other that isn't heard. To really listen, to proactively listen, take extreme effort, and then to try to understand what is going on from the other's emotional perspective. Boy, even harder when you have your own emotions going on.
Well, because when that person is talking, you're already figuring out what you're going to say back to them, right? Rather than listening to what they're saying to you.
Exactly. Exactly.
I mean, that's the narrative, right?
Yes. Oh, no, absolutely. So I'm thinking, in I call this the tribes effect in the book. And it's a divisive mindset. In a conflict situation, the moment we feel threatened on some level, all of a sudden it becomes me versus you. Your perspective is illegitimate and crazy. Mine is perfect and right. I'm going to close my ears to you. I'm going to totally defend my perspective. This is the essential problem of conflict. It's not behavior. It's a mindset. If you get stuck in this, good luck.
Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Daniel Shapiro, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. He's the founder and director of the Harvard International Negotiation Program. He's also the author of a new book that's called Negotiating the Non-Negotiable, How to Resolve Your Most Emotionally Charged Conflicts. We've been talking a lot about interpersonal conflicts, their issues related to the workplace, and certainly political issues as well. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne talking with Daniel Shapiro about negotiations, negotiating the non-negotiable, the title of his new book. He says, at the root of conflict are things such as identity and emotions, and they play such a significant and important role. 1-888-477-9499, the number to call to join our conversation. You talk about the tribal effect, and I think it's interesting use of the word tribe, meaning that we are in many ways sort of primitive and tribal, certainly when we think about our emotions.
A tribe is like a family. It is what we feel, what and who we feel closest to. We emotionally invest in the tribe, and we are absolutely loyal to our tribe. To the extent that often in conflict situation, whether it's between marketing and research or within the family, the content doesn't matter. I must maintain loyalty to my tribe. I will, you know, whatever the Republican line is or Democrat line, I'm going to maintain loyalty to that, even if it might not make sense to do so.
Because it's identification, and it's what the mob mentality.
It's I think it's different than the mob mentality. The mob is sort of, you're part of an amorphous whole. This has much more definition to it. I am a part of the Facebook tribe or the Google, or I'm a part of ISIS. I have an identity, and I am going to uphold that identity and the pride of that identity with my life, with my last breath. And should someone try to threaten that tribe, watch out. That is an assault on the sacred. I will come back in full force.
Well, I have many questions for you about ISIS, because in many ways that feels like negotiating the non-negotiable.
Yeah.
This is a terrorist group. Obviously, they do horrendous violence to Muslims and to their captors.
Yeah.
Is it possible to negotiate with a terrorist organization like that?
There are two ways of answering this question. One, if someone storms into my office and starts shooting a gun, I think I and most people would wisely either run, or we jointly would come and try and tackle that person. It's not a moment to negotiate, I don't think. On the other hand, these terrorist organizations are organizations, and those organizations are ripe for negotiation on multiple levels. One, they are on many levels communicating with us through their amazing media usage.
Absolutely.
And we can communicate back. You can have a media negotiation on some level. Second, who are the gatekeepers? Who are the people who at an identity level, an emotional and ideological level, are influencing, deeply influencing the mindset of this entire tribe, of, let's say, ISIS tribe? Who are those religious leaders or quasi-religious leaders espousing the ideologies that say that it's okay to commit extremely violent and heinous acts against innocent people? And might there be a way through some third parties to influence their thinking, right, to help them shift the line of taboo, shift the line of what is acceptable to do in line with their own ideology? That's plausible.
Well, and I mean, on the one hand, you could say, well, I'm just going to argue with them and say you're wrong and it's not in the Quran and, all the sort of rational arguments against them.
Yeah.
Is that effective?
In the book, I write about an example. I had a conversation a number of years back with a very eminent lawyer who had this unusual opportunity to meet with a potential terrorist, a suicide bomber, before he went off and did his reprehensible deed to strap a bomb to himself, to his chest, and so on. The question was, what would you say to that 14-year-old kid who's about to go and do that to try and persuade him otherwise? And this particular lawyer's approach was to say a beautiful, really brilliant argument. Look, you're 14 years old. You have your whole life ahead of you. Imagine what you can do in the next 60, 70, 80 years in terms of economic help within your own society, political work. You could become a political leader. You're going to be in the news tomorrow for one day. That's it. Then you're going to disappear. And as I was listening to this lawyer's argument, I thought, boy, that's a profound and beautiful argument. And yet it also feels a little rational and Western. And so, from my perspective, one would have to entertain the 14-year-old from his own worldview, from his own religious and ideological worldview, to talk about, if it were the Quran or some other religious text, depending upon the religion, to talk in that language, to talk from that person's sphere of identity, how they see the world.
Is that why if I can call them that, ex-terrorists can be effective? I mean, I've heard interviews with a number of people who were part of some terrorist organization who left.
Mm-hmm.
Is it because they can speak that language?
They know the language, absolutely. And it is the language that matters. It's not the verbal, it's not the English or whatever, Arabic or something else. It is the language of understanding deeply from an identity perspective what matters to this group, what matters to the individuals. Is it about religion? Is it about the fact that you're going to go to a heaven and you're going to meet a number of virgins there? Is it about just the mere fact that you seem really cool and, wow, I was on the cover of the New York Times with my gun? What is it? And if they have that deeper understanding of the fuller emotional perspective of what is incentivizing these terrorists to do what they're doing, that's the power to change.
You've been involved, I know, in some of the negotiations involving the Middle East. This is all a very, very complicated region of the world. And I think from an outsider, you could say, does this work? I mean, you look at the Middle East and certainly the Israeli-Palestinian crisis has not been resolved yet.
Yeah.
Are there things in here that haven't been applied to that part of the world that you think could be more effective?
Absolutely. Most of the books that are out there on negotiation, conflict resolution, sort of the quick fix. Here are the tactics that you can do to better negotiate, to come to a rational solution. Negotiating the non-negotiable is not a quick fix.
Right.
It's a real fix. How do we deal with the deeper relationship divisions that are dividing Israeli from Israeli, Palestinian from Palestinian, Israeli from Palestinian? And until we get to these deeper issues, working to truly reconcile the deeper relationship, no agreement's going to work. Mm. I mean, looking, for example, in South Africa right now or in Northern Ireland, yes, you know, they have a signed agreement in Northern Ireland. There's still a lot of tension. How do you deal with the deeper relational issues? That's what this book is about.
And that's about identity. I mean, just to sort of underscore the theme of this book, it's about who people believe that they are.
It's about identity, but it's a special kind of identity. It's what I call your relational identity. So if you imagine, you know, let's say two stick figures fighting, there's each one that has their own identity, a core identity. Then there's the relationship between them. I'm not going to be able to convert one person to a completely different religion if we're in the middle of a battle.
Right.
I can change the relationship between us. And the challenge is, how do you do so in a true and effective way? That's what a lot of my work is in the Middle East. It's trying to dig into those deeper levels. How do you deal with the taboo issues that are at play? How do you deal with the constant repetition of conflict? It's the same old patterns again and again. Let's break it.
Well, you mentioned the word taboo. I mean, I think we know what that means, which is there are things that cannot be talked about.
Mm.
You're saying talk about them or sort of shift the language we use in talking about things like taboos?
Well, one has to think whether you want to talk about these issues.
Right.
I mean, taboos.
And often they're fraught, right? I mean, that's why it's a taboo.
Absolutely. If I break a taboo, I do something wrong, you know, and in my conversation with you, Marty, I call you Mary instead of Marty or something. Suddenly,
it's happened before, okay. I have to say, but that's fine.
But I get the social punishment then. You know, the next question is like the hardest ball question. You know, your book is completely stupid. I read it and, you know, and it becomes very serious in these situations of, you know, substantial conflict. In the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, core question, how do you negotiate that which you cannot discuss? Taboo. How do you negotiate, for example, when some Israelis or Palestinians will not call the other by their name? And I'm not arguing politically whether one should or shouldn't. I'm just saying practically, how do you negotiate when these taboos stand right at the heart? It's a wall between you and me. I can't even talk to you. It's taboo for us to talk to each other. How are we ever going to come to a peace if I can't sit in the same room and talk with you without being ostracized from my community?
You're saying break the taboo.
I'm saying consider breaking the taboo. Right. So in the book, I talk about a framework, ACT. Three ways you can break it down. I can accept it. You know, so in the family context, maybe it's taboo to talk about mom's drinking. I can accept, you know what, let's just not talk about it. But at the same time, I watch mom and she's drinking herself to death. C, I might try and chisel it away. Chisel at that taboo very gently. I'll talk with her doctor, talk with her best friend, say, you know what, we have to figure something out.
Mm-hmm.
Tearing it down, that was Mandela in South Africa. We are all one. I am you, you are me, Ubuntu, we are all together. We're going to tear down this taboo of division. And boom, it was risky. He risked his life. Others in the Middle East, they've lost their lives breaking the taboo toward peace. How do you deal with it?
Yeah. Let me quickly reintroduce you. That's Daniel Shapiro. He's got a new book. It's called Negotiating the Non-Negotiable, and he's the founder and director of the Harvard International Negotiation Program. In fact, is a psychology professor at Harvard Medical School and affiliate faculty on negotiations at the law school there at Harvard. And we are talking about some of the ideas in this book. We've got calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. And you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. I see a bunch of them. And you can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me make a weird segue from the Middle East to the workplace. But you know, this is where we spend, what, 8, 9, 10, sometimes 10 hours of our lives every day at the workplace.
Mm-hmm.
It can be filled and fraught with conflict. You talk about always consult before deciding.
One of the most prominent reasons that parties tend to get into conflict is that somebody makes a decision without consulting somebody else. I mean, one of the major reasons I get called into organizations, someone brings me, you know, into their office, closes the door. My colleague down the hall, he, she made this big decision. They did not even consult me, and it affects my entire project, or it affects this entire corporation. The simplest way out of that in the organization, ACBD, always consult before deciding, especially around decisions that are important to that other person.
But why wouldn't someone consult before deciding? I mean, what prevents someone from doing that?
Well, I think we're often fearful. Might they reject my ideas? Sometimes we just don't even think about it. Well, I have the authority to make the decision here. Why do I need to consult?
Right.
You know, you look, there was a famous situation a few years ago with the head of Yahoo, Marissa Meyer, who had decided to have those who had been working outside of the company all come back in. Now you had the mothers, the fathers who'd been working at home suddenly go, wait a minute, I was working pretty fine from home. Now you're telling me to come back. I'm sure her intent was positive. I want to build a community here at Yahoo. I don't want us all spread out. And yet at the same time, my advice to her would have been, boy, consult, consult, consult. You still have the authority to make the decision. But before you make that decision, learn as much as you can, then make the decision.
Should we think of our work family as family? I mean, there's some of the same dynamics at play at work. I mean, it's hierarchical to some degree the way families are, but is that helpful?
It's a system.
It's a system.
The work
right.
is a system, and it often can feel like a tribe. We are all working together. There's a hierarchy within that tribe. And I think about the concepts of this book. One in particular comes to mind. Freud originally called it the repetition compulsion.
Right. I know it well. Yes.
You know,
I do.
Well, we all know it well. We might not know that we know it well, though. And it is the idea that we tend to repeat the same dysfunctional patterns of behavior again and again and again and again. And in the workplace, we see it. The same poor decision-making processes happen again and again. And without taking a step back to understand those patterns and to ask the question, how do we break those patterns, change them? You have an organization that may be, scoring an 8 out of 10, but they could be doing a 10 out of 10 if they just look at how conflict is being dealt with. The problem with the repetition compulsion...
Go ahead.
The problem with the repetition compulsion, it feels unnatural to break away from it.
Because it's familiar?
Because it's familiar.
It's how we do things around here kind of thing?
And, yes, absolutely. And because it becomes a part of our identity. This is a part of who I am. Not just what I do, but who I am. I have a very close friend. Was in the midst of a 25-year long relationship with her life partner. Totally emotionally abusive relationship. And she's a brilliant, brilliant person and lawyer. Beautiful person, spiritually evolved and so on. Finally, just about 2 months ago now, breaks out of this relationship, goes to D.C. with some friends. And what does she do every single day? Shall I go back? And she calls him. Shall I not go back? Shall I go back? And she was, as one of my colleagues at Harvard Medical School, now deceased, Paul Russell, put it, like a mosquito drawn to that fatal flame. And I regret to say, now about 2 weeks ago, she went back.
She did.
She did. But at the same time, we had
talked. Did she go back a different person or? Go ahead.
No, that's exactly right. So she grew. She absolutely grew through this process. Maybe another year, another two, right. She might be able to break out for good. But she started to see the dynamic that she was in. She started to see her place in that relationship and started to move toward that conscious decision of empowerment over the emotional dynamic rather than it controlling her.
Are you a good negotiator in your own life?
I mean,
have you learned some of the... And I ask that not to be hostile or facetious, mm-hmm. but sometimes people become experts in the things that they're not so good at, if you know what I mean.
Oh, no. I totally understand that. Boy, I'd probably be the last person to judge. You'd have to ask my wife and my kids. I can tell you I try my hardest to apply these concepts, and I find them helpful. My wife would, I'm sure, agree with me as well. The ability to put words to some of these dynamics that we otherwise fall victim to, it's useful. You know, so for example, with my wife and I, we get into a conflict situation. It starts to get a little heated. Either of us will say to the other, wait a minute. You know,
vertigo.
Exactly.
It's happening.
And then we have the question in front of us. Do we want to go there? You know, and sometimes we make the human decision to go there and we have a 2-hour uncomfortable conversation. But more often than not, we have the choice in front of us and we can move it in the constructive direction. So, you know, we're all human beings. At the end of the day, what the book is about is really here's some skills, some tools, some ideas so that you can label these emotional situations that we're all in. And you can deal with it. You can empower yourself.
We're almost up on a break here, but you call it the non-negotiable. I mean, what you're saying is that the non-negotiable is negotiable when all is said and done.
Amen.
It just feels that way.
Yes. Well, it's a mindset. It feels non-negotiable. And yet at the end of the day, it's not that most of these situations are indeed objectively non-negotiable. It's that they feel that way. And if you can break out of that mindset, you open up possibility.
Well, let's take that short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. I see a bunch of comments here and we've got some calls as well. And again, Daniel Shapiro is our guest in this hour of Radio Times. He's the founder and director of the Harvard International Negotiation Program. He is a psychology professor at Harvard Medical School, also affiliated with the law school there at Harvard as well. He's written a bunch of books, including a new one called Negotiating the Non-Negotiable. I think you have a sense of some of his ideas, and it's subtitled How to Resolve Your Most Emotionally Charged Conflicts. Call us at 1-888-477-9499. I'll read a bunch of emails, radiotimes@whyy.org. And we've got a bunch of tweets as well at WHYY Radio Times. Much more after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We're talking about conflict and negotiation with our guest, Daniel Shapiro. And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. And I do want to read some tweets, but Kevin, our engineer, has a question for you. And this is, how, though, do you deal with someone who is combative and they know they are right and you are wrong and just make it really difficult to have any kind of negotiation? How do you defuse that?
I think this is most conflict situations. You know, we often think, boy, that other person's so combative and I am the nicest person in the world. Maybe.
You're saying you may not be the nicest
person? I think if I ask the other side, how do you think that the person on the other in the other chair is as a negotiator? Oh, boy, they are confrontational. Each side has their story that the other is combative, confrontational. That doesn't deny your story from being true. One of the most powerful tools you have at your disposal is to turn that other person from an adversary into a partner. And it's to reshape the nature of your relationship so it's no longer me versus you, but it's the two of us facing the same shared challenge. You're not the problem. I'm not the problem. Here's the problem right in front of us.
How do you do that, though?
One of the simplest tools, ask advice. So, you know, people love to have their perspective. So say, look, we've been in this conflict for the past 15 minutes or the past 15 years here at work. I don't think it served either of us well. You know, you could fight, I could fight. I don't think it's going to do well. You know, what is your advice on how we might try to deal with this conflict more effectively together? And that's a powerful shift. As an example,
you're using the word we for one.
Yes.
Right?
It is the we, and you need that. And in the book, I call it the relentless we. As much as there's the I and the you and the me and the them, you need the we, us, as just as much at least, to overpower the emotional force of the destruction, of the destructive mentality.
What are we going to do about this, you're saying?
What are we going to do about it? And just as one quick example, there was a longstanding conflict between Peru and Ecuador. U.S. State Department called this the longest standing armed conflict in the history of the Western Hemisphere. And 1998, Jamil Mahuad was elected president of Ecuador. So it turns out he'd been a student of my colleague, Roger Fisher's. And at some point later, a student of mine, he calls up our organization. I'd love your advice. I'm about to meet with President Fujimori. When I sit down to negotiate this land dispute with him, what do I say? What do I do? And one of the biggest pieces of advice, ask advice.
Oh, wow.
You've been a president for 7-8 years. I've been a president for about 8 days. You know, what is your advice on what we might effectively and practically do? You know, and I know much more about Ecuador's needs than you do, but so let's sit down together. And in the first hand, he's written about how these kinds of tools were essential in shifting the dynamic from literally war between Ecuador and Peru to ultimately 10 meetings later, a peace agreement between Peru and Ecuador.
So it's about pronouns?
It's about, it is about pronouns, but I don't think it's just about the word. It's about the intent. Do I honestly, you know, so I can say, you know, well, we're going to figure this out.
Yeah, I hear it, right.
I think it's really about the sincerity, the genuineness of that intent to work cooperatively. And for the business person, you might be shaking your head going, ugh, this is not useful. This can't happen. Or the divorced couple. My response, open your mind to the possibility. This is powerful stuff. The research substantiates it. And I work around the world with families in crisis, countries in crisis.
But are there, I mean, do you think that there are then some conflicts for whatever reason, they just can't be solved?
Well, I think
they can't be fixed.
I think fixing and solving aren't necessarily the goals. I call it resolving in the book, but even that isn't quite right. At the end of the day, the husband and wife, or the spouses, I should say, in the midst of a long-term marriage, they get into, it's not going to make sense if either turns to the other and say, well, who's winning our marriage?
Doesn't work that way.
And then I think it should be the same concept in our political system. Who's winning the United States right now? Democrats or Republicans? Independents? No, we want a United States of America where we're all winning. We're all part of this country. You're all part of the marriage. I don't think it's about finding a quick fix. I think it's about finding long-term ways of helping us to relate more effectively to one another.
I want to pick up on the political thing, but let me get a couple of callers in. We've got Nicholas from Delaware County joining us on Radio Times. Hi, Nicholas. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Listen, I wanted to ask you guys, you're talking about conflict and asking the other party for advice in terms of in your relationship. Now, when I do that, I believe in getting as much advice as possible before making a decision. But lately, I'm getting feedback that I need to take the initiative and I need to step up. And how do I reconcile that with what you're suggesting?
Oh, that's interesting. Nicholas, thanks for the call.
Nicholas, thank you. It's a great question. I think there are two sides of the coin. The one side is that I do want to empathize, or as I was calling it earlier, appreciate the other side's perspective, to build that connection. At the same time, there's also this core element of assertiveness. I want to assert my own needs in this situation as well. And the utterly empathic negotiator can be a bad negotiator because they're not asserting for their own needs or the needs of their client, their organization. I was recently working with the CEO of a prominent organization, utterly empathic of the other side. He understood the other side's perspective to death, and yet he was getting walked over by this other person. And the big advice was, well, wait a minute. They have interests. You understand the other side's interests, but you have interests too. What can you say? What can you do to assert your interests? So my advice, assert.
Nicholas, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. So thanks a lot. Let me read an email from Mary, a husband in a midlife crisis for about 4 years, major revelation recently that his animosity towards me seems to be his family and their ways cannot be questioned. I asked him the other day, you use the word we with your family, but not us. Mm. When did you become a we with your family again and set a dynamite against your marriage? I mean, talk about pronouns, but it sounds like, Mary, we obviously can't do justice to your situation here, but it seems like some of this language might be giving some things away in this situation.
I mean, to me, Mary, thank you for your sharing this. The question is, how do you best deal with this with your husband? And, first of all, it sounds like there is hurt due to this felt rejection by your husband. I thought we were a team, and you're now saying that there is no we. One of the things that you might consider doing would be to sit down at the right moment with your husband and say, let's talk about this. So in other words, you start to approach what you're sharing now with us on this show.
Right.
To approach this with your husband as a problem that you both share. I want a good relationship. I want that we that we used to have. I feel it eroding now. I noticed it, for example, when you called your family we and not me as part of that we. What are your thoughts on how we might try to improve that relationship between us? And you open up a we dialogue about the fact that you don't feel a part of the we.
Good luck to you, Mary. Thanks for calling, or thanks for sending us an email. Here's a tweet from Gordon. He says, is conflict simply part of our human condition? If so, why do we treat it as inherently negative?
Well, we don't all treat it as inherently negative. I think conflict absolutely is unavoidable. In the research, we call it, there's destructive conflict, there's constructive conflict. Destructive conflict, when that divorcing couple tears the seams of the relationship apart, the 7-year-old's crying in the background, and it's, you know, it's over whether the child should have 2 sweets a day or one. You know, the constructive approach to conflict resolution is everybody working together. You can still have negative emotions, you can still have strong emotions, but again, it's back to that we, that pronoun. Yeah. You're right. It's how do we work on this most effectively together? One of the dangers I point out in the book is how easy it is to fall into the traps of tribalism. Me versus you, us versus them. And the moment that happens, the conflict easily can become destructive. So my notion there is, how do you build that communal mindset? It's the two of us working together. It's all of us within the organization.
But what I hear you saying is be mindful of the language that you use, because your language is revealing a lot about how you feel, who you think this other person is in your life, mm-hmm. and if there's a possibility of some kind of negotiation or agreement.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so before your next conflict, you might grab a friend and tell that friend to play you. You play the other person, right, and see what feels right in terms of the language.
Really? Do a role play?
Absolutely. We do that all the time. A role reversal exercise is one of the most useful tools we've found. Two people are in the midst of a fight. Play your side, they play the other, and then switch roles. And you suddenly get into this uncomfortable realization that there may be some emotional legitimacy to the other side's perspective. It doesn't make it right.
Yeah.
You know, but at least you understand it.
Let me see what Nico from South Philadelphia has to say. Nico, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi there.
Hi there.
I'll try to sum it up quickly.
Sure.
Recently, I've gone through a breakup due to some slow eroding and outside stressors like finance, a search for new work, difficulties with mental illness, because each of us have bipolar 1 and 2 respectively, so emotional flooding can be a big issue. We've now separated about a month ago, and though he was completely shut down for about 3 weeks, he finally got onto a dating app, and he stated that he's dating and sexually active, and we are only in limited text conversations now. How could I go about trying to, like, make a change and make positive change and reunite in a situation like this?
Nico, you want to get back with him? Is that what you're saying?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there are far more good things about the relationship than bad, and we are inspiring to each other. Brought me back to, like, working on my dream job. Like, we had so many good things, but the argument became kind of aggressive because of the emotional flooding, and it led right. to him feeling kind of threatened and, you know, unheard and things like that, because we both, you know, he would be silence and I would be violence in a conflict, right? Mm-hmm. I want to talk about it, and he wants to shut down.
Interesting.
And so it can be a bad combo, but similarly, it can be complementary because of our different styles, you know?
I hear you. Yeah. And but what you're also saying is that it looks like he's looking to maybe move on or is interested in other people. This is a tough one, Daniel Shapiro.
Well, is that right? I mean, do you sense that he might be interested in getting back together?
I sense that he's conflicted, but he's kind of riding out that wave of hurt. And so, like, I mean, for instance, that 3 weeks that he was shut down, he felt the need to connect, like, basically weekly, and even said, you know, he had only played video games and watched television and binge-watched TV and eaten, like, junk, you know, and so he wasn't moving on. And so the only thing that's brought him to kind of pull himself out of the house has been, again, seeking validation through another person.
Right.
I mean, so it's coinciding with him seeing somebody and being validated. You know what I mean?
Sure, Nico. And you know this is complicated, so there's only a little sort of strands of information we can deal with. Go ahead, Dan.
Yeah.
Two quick thoughts. One, repetition compulsion. Could be useful to take some time today, for example, to sit down and really plot out what is that typical pattern, the dysfunctional cycle that you tend to get into with them in the conflict situations. And is there one or perhaps two behaviors, just one or two, that you might change in your next interaction with him to make it less likely you're going to move into that negative us versus them dynamic. Second, in the book I talk about something called your mythos of identity. What I mean is this is the core relationship narrative that you have that drives everything in the relationship. And it's easy to it's fairly easy to discover. You might just think through, what's a metaphor that you might draw on to describe the nature of your relationship, the emotional nature of your relationship with him, you know, at this point in time and when you're in conflict? Is it that he's Goliath and you're David? Or is it that he's, you know, a tough soldier and you're the easygoing comedian? I don't know what it is, but what is that metaphor? Because that gets to the deeper elements of your own fears, his fears, without going through all the, you know, without 20 years of psychoanalysis. This is a fast approach to getting to some of that core. And once you understand that, and in the book I talk about this, you then can think through how could you change that metaphor a little bit to empower yourself. So maybe David, if it's David and Goliath, David, you know, eats extra Cheerios that day and extra big and has more control over Goliath. They can build that relationship.
Nico, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Dan, you had mentioned earlier about our political season that we're in. It seems like all conversations lead to our presidential election. My apologies for doing that. But nonetheless, there is a question about once all is said and done and once people vote in November, whoever the winner is, how do you then bring a country together when they've – and it looks like it's going to be a pretty brutal fight for the White House this year. How does whoever win and perhaps whoever loses, how do they bring the country together or can they?
I hope. There are two different kinds of identity, negative identity and positive identity. What we are seeing now in the political campaigning process is an extreme use of negative identity, which means I am defining myself and my campaign as against yours. I am not you.
That's politics, though, isn't it?
Well, it's a part.
Or is this even
it's a
more
part of politics. I think this is extreme negative identity. But what is missing is the positive identity. You know, I care less about who you're not. What I really want to know is who are you? And my hope is that whoever takes on that role of the president is able to define the basic, really to advocate for that positive identity. In the book, I call it brave.
Yeah.
What are the beliefs that define who we are, not who we're not? What are the rituals, the allegiances, the values, the emotionally meaningful experiences that become the threads that hold this fabric of the United States together? We need that defined. I think that the risk right now is that this tribalism that's happening can reverberate and outlast the conclusion of the voting process. In other words, you continue to have an increasingly tribal Congress and so on. But I think with the right promotion of a common identity, we can do it.
Does the loser, if I can put it that way, do they have a role to play in this, though?
I think everybody has a role to play. The loser, the winner, everybody has a role if it is a true we.
A true we. Daniel Shapiro, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
It's a complete pleasure and honor.
Thank you so much. And he's the founder, director of the Harvard International Negotiation Program. And he's got a new book. It's called Negotiating the Non-Negotiable, How to Resolve Your Most Emotionally Charged Conflicts. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times. You can find out much more about this program. You can download a podcast of the show. Find us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Bilder, Emily Bryant, John Ahrens, and Liz Fiedler. I'm Marty Moscoe. Thank you so much for joining us.